Robert Frost once said that poetry is talking about one thing in terms of another. No one will accuse me of committing a poetic act here today, but I will be talking about one thing in terms of another. Specifically, I will be talking about the attenuation of the sacramental sensibilities, which it has been the historical privilege and responsibility of Catholic Christianity to awaken, and on which the vibrancy of Catholic faith largely depends. And I will do so by reflecting on the contest over church bells in 19th and 20th century Europe. The burden of these short reflections is best encapsulated by something written by Mark McIntosh, quote, "It is as if a particular language skill had been left to atrophy, and therefore a whole realm of life, custom, and reality for which this language was the medium has become lost," end quote. I've chosen to exemplify this predicament in relationship to church bells for the same reason that the French historian Alain Corbin undertook his exhaustive study of the controversy over church bells in 19th century France. Corbin wanted, he wrote, quote, "to study the genesis of meaninglessness and the evolution and diffusion of modes of incomprehension." In that, Andrei Tarkovsky's 1966 cinematic tribute to the great Russian iconographer Andrei Rublev, the turning point for Rublev happens when he and two other monks with whom he is wandering arrive at a village where preparations are underway to replace the bell in the village bell tower. The old bell maker has died, and his unproven son, Baryshka, has inherited the formidable and precarious task of creating a new bell. "My father, the old snake," Baryshka complains, "didn't pass on the secret. He died without telling me. He took it to the grave. Skinflint scoundrel." Such is the justified lament of those whose forebears have neglected the task of cultural transmission. This lament should haunt those of us who, through no merit of our own, have been the beneficiaries of Christian truth, a gift we received from the imperfect but nonetheless earnest hands of our predecessors in the faith. Were we to fail to pass on this faith to those who come after us, or if we pass on a lifeless replica of a once living faith, we will be as culpable as the old bell maker. Andrei Rublev, whose gift for iconography were legendary at the time, abandoned icon writing, however, and took a vow of silence. His fellow monks recognized his gift. He nevertheless saw his own vocational ambivalence mirrored in the young bell maker's dilemma. Rublev watched silently as the drama of the bell casting unfolded. Under pressure of social expectations and metallurgical uncertainties, the young Baryshka supervised the digging of the pit, the selection of the clay, the shaping of the mold, the firing of the furnaces, the pouring of the molten bronze, and finally, the hoisting of the bell into the tower. When the new bell rang perfectly at the consecration ceremony, the young, inexperienced bell maker collapsed in tears. Rublev cradled the boy in his arms. Breaking his vow of silence, he said, "Let's go together. You'll cast bells, I'll paint icons." Tarkovsky's film makes it perfectly clear that 15th century Russia was as sorely in need, as most ages are, of theological instruction and catechesis. Under the circumstances, it might seem strange that a heart filled with faith and zeal would find the casting of church bells or the fashioning of icons to be the timeliest task to take up. Christianity, however, is not merely and not primarily a set of beliefs. It is a way of life, a participation in an ongoing historical drama, set in motion and finally determined by the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. If Tarkovsky helps us to appreciate the fact that church bells were themselves the result of technological skill, products of the practical arts, the philosopher and Roman Catholic priest Ivan Illich reminds us of the religious impulse out of which these technologies of remembrance arose. Quote from Illich: "The belief that technological devices can be intimately associated with the celebration of a biblical religion is arguably one of the deep roots out of which the European attitude toward technology has grown. Buildings and domestic animals, swords and plows, bridal beds and cradles are among the innumerable things thus solemnly lifted into the sphere of faith. The blessing of the church bell is only one of these liturgies, albeit a very solemn one, for its sound somehow creates the community around it." End quote. We who have been cavalierly dismantling those things that foster communal bonds need to awaken to how precious and delicate these bonds are. For once lost, violence is the default ruse for conjuring up crude facsimiles of social solidarity. The bonds that bind are so attenuated in our time that it is hard for us even to imagine the community-binding function that the church bells played in an earlier age. Writes Elaine Corbin, quote, "The rural peals of the 19th century, which have become for us the sound of another time, were listened to and evaluated according to a system of affects that is now lost to us. They bear witness to a different relation to the world and to the sacred, as well as to a different way of being inscribed in time and space, and of experiencing time and space. Bell ringing constituted a language and founded a system of communication that has gradually broken down. It gave rhythm to forgotten modes of relating between individuals and between the living and the dead. It made possible forms of expression now lost to us of rejoicing and conviviality." End quote. Born in Vienna in 1926, Ivan Illich grew up with bells. "Their sound," he wrote, "is part and parcel of each European place that I remember." End quote. That Illich retained his ear for the subtle resonances of church bells throughout his life is suggested by an aside he made well into his seventh decade. Quote, "As I write this in a Mexican village, two bells are ringing. I know their name because I recognize their voices. I am surprised that today the rosary will be said so late, and it takes me some time to figure out the reason. Like everyone else, I hear the sound of the third tolling of the passing bell that lets us know that Don Jose is still breathing and that we are all sharing in his last hour." End quote. Such was the mysterious role of bells in pre-modern and early modern Europe that revolutionary movements were not slow to recognize that the bells were incompatible with their effort of radical reconfiguration. Alain Corbin declared the contest over church bells during the French Revolution to have been an effort, quote, "designed to bring about a disenchantment of the world by altering the temporal architecture of everyday life," end quote. A subsequent effort to expel Christianity's cultural influence by eliminating the ensemble of choreographic cues occurred in Andrei Rublev's Russia in the early 20th century. The Bolsheviks came to realize that the church bells in rural Russia were the cultural cornerstones of a worldview with which their revolution was incompatible. "For both the Bolsheviks and the Russian peasants," writes the historian Richard Hernandez, quote, "the bells symbolized the village's older religious identity over and against Bolshevik attempts to reconfigure or destroy that identity," end quote. By 1929, the patience of the Soviet Central Council in Moscow had run out, It declared church bells to be counter-revolutionary instruments of resistance. The bells were to be confiscated, melted down for use in the industrialization of Soviet society. The communists were clever enough to realize that an alternative auditory cue would be necessary. Consequently, the regime began experimenting with alternatives. Chief among them was the factory whistle, which replaced the bells as the auditory reminder of the meaning of the temporal order. In addition, there were loudspeakers and radios, which had no on and off switches, and which issued incessant party propaganda. Perhaps the most ludicrous Bolshevik assault on the senses were the factory whistle symphonies and the noise orchestra, to which the recalcitrant peasants were helplessly exposed. That noise would have been thought a worthy substitute for the pealing of a church bell indicates how anthropologically tone-deaf the Bolsheviks were. For, in fact, the church bell is a kind of anti-noise. It is, writes John Sr., quote, the strike of silence. For in a noisy world, it takes a striking sound within whose widening circles noise is hollowed out, end quote. The bells keep time in that special sacramental sense. They keep time from being flattened into mere chronology by punctuating temporality with an auditory reminder of a transcendent destiny. Once awakened, this hunger for transcendent meaning is not easily eliminated, and efforts to feed it on merely mundane visions of happiness lead almost ineluctably to violence on a massive scale. The Christian task today is to reawaken that hunger and reorient it toward its true object, and to do so, as T.S. Eliot would say, under conditions that seem quite unpropitious. For a glimmer of hope in this regard, let me turn back to the 19th century. Midway between the French and Russian revolutions, something subtle but nonetheless quite significant occurred. In the summer of 1857, the French painter Jean-François Millet completed a painting entitled Prayer for the Potato Crop. The painting, depicting two peasants, a man and a woman, with heads bowed, hands folded in prayer, surrounded by a vast and furrowed landscape of dubious agricultural fecundity, had been commissioned by Thomas Gold Appleton, a well-born, wealthy, and well-connected member of the Boston gentry of the day. Mr. Appleton, a man of Irish descent, surely chose this theme in light of the ravages of the Irish potato famine, 1845 to 52. Appleton declined, however, to take possession of the painting, and Millet subsequently returned to it, adding a church tower on the distant horizon and changing the name of the painting to the Angelus, thus transforming the social realism of the original painting into the sacramental realism of the final one. Millet seems to have been grateful for the provocation and satisfied with the result. When his lifelong friend and agent, Alfred Sensier, first saw the painting on Millet's easel, the artist asked, "Well, what do you think?" "It's the Angelus," acknowledged Sensier, to which Millet replied, "Can you hear the bells?" Speaking of one thing in terms of another, this is our question. Can we hear the bell? Are we daily touched by subtle reminders of life's brevity, meaning, mystery, and grandeur? Many French Catholics living half a century after the ravages of the Revolution, in which church bells had been so fiercely contested, were as quick to, quote, hear the bells as the artist's friend had been. In its altered states, Millet's painting was to become one of the most cherished artworks of the age, reproduced by some accounts more often than the Mona Lisa. Since only the second iteration of the painting came to the attention of a wider public, it's impossible to compare the relative popularity of the two versions. Nevertheless, it is safe to say that the original painting, similar in so many ways to other Millet paintings and other paintings of the time, would not have met with the astonishing enthusiasm that was awakened by the Angelus. The question is, what might account for the popularity of the altered painting, which is perfectly indistinguishable from the original one, except for two almost imperceptible details. In both its original and refashioned form, Millet's painting is dominated by a foreground scene of peasant toil, hardship, and piety. In the original painting, no less than the later one, the uncovered head of the man and the folded hands of the woman indicate that they are at prayer. A peasant couple turning to prayer in the face of economic hardship is a poignant theme, perhaps, but had not the church tower been added to the distant horizon and explicitly related to the foreground by the artist's new title, neither the poignancy of humble hardship nor the piety of the couple burdened by it would likely have touched the nerve that their altered painting did. The artist's comment, "Can you hear the bells?" obviously suggests that it was his intention to make them visually audible, and both his friend's response and the popularity of the painting indicate that he succeeded. In the original painting, the two peasants facing material hardship are praying, quite obviously for divine help with or divine consolation for their material difficulty. In the altered painting, on the contrary, the couple, their material plight unchanged from the original painting, have turned to prayer not in response to economic hardships. Their prayer has been prompted by an ecclesial tradition and not by fluctuations in their material fortune. What comes to the fore in the altered painting is not poverty and piety, but the gift of tradition and the moral dignity and beauty of those whose lives are ordered to the rhythm of liturgical time. It is precisely this, I think, which endowed the painting with the peculiar power it came to have on the imagination of late 19th century Europe. On hearing the Angelus bells, the couple in Millet's painting promptly ceased their labors and bowed their heads in prayer, thereby subordinating themselves to a pattern of life not of their own making. Therein, contrary to all our contemporary prejudices, lies their freedom and triumph over circumstance. We see them not only in an act of prayer, but more remarkably still, in an act of obedience, one, moreover, all the more gracious, inasmuch as it took place almost instinctively upon hearing the Angelus bells. The painting is far more about the church, its bells, and the ecclesial choreography of liturgical time than any material exigencies that might have been the immediate circumstances of the praying couple. The painting simply superimposes Augustine's two cities, the city of God and the earthly city, at the moment when the former has revealed its primacy. With a few strokes of his brush, Millet recommissioned his earlier painting, thereby awakening a largely inchoate longing for an ecclesial and liturgical way of life, the gradual disappearance of which few had been attentive enough to consciously lament. What Norman Rockwell did, for example, for mid-20th century Protestant America, Millet did for mid-19th century Catholic Europe. There is a sense in Millet's painting, as in Rockwell, of a vanishing world of whose gradual disappearance the figures in the painting remain mercifully unaware, but of which countless admirers of these paintings were poignantly reminded. "Tell me what you see vanishing," wrote the poet W.S. Merwin, "and I will tell you who you are." If what late 19th century Frenchmen saw vanishing in Millet's painting was the church bells and the unself-conscious piety they invoke, we are perhaps in a position to see in the painting the attenuation of another of the gifts traceable to the Christian order of the world. For what ordered and deepened the spiritual lives of the couple in the painting enriched as well their nuptial relationship. For those attentive to these matters can detect the Trinitarian structure of that relationship. Their love for one another is not binary, binary relationships being unstable and fraught with difficulty. Their love for one another is inseparable from the love they both have for something or someone else. In this case, everything represented by the church in the distance and the sound of the bells coming from its tower. This more subtle innuendo of the painting might come more fully into focus in our time, as what we see vanishing is the Christian understanding of the nuptial mystery, dissolving under the influence of the same cultural and historical forces that conspire to replace the church bells with a cacophony of auditory cues antithetical to the purpose. In the same year that the confiscation of church bells began in Russia, a young Spanish artist who had been haunted by Millet's Angelus encountered a new reproduction of it. Salvador Dali was so disquieted by it that he began to see the world through the lens of the painting, albeit in accord with his own surrealistic and hallucinogenic frame of mind. Quote, "The Angelus of Millet," Dali wrote, "suddenly became for me the pictorial work that was the most troubling, the most enigmatic, the most dense, and the richest in unconscious thoughts I had ever seen," end quote. Dali poured a vast amount of energy into mocking the painting over a period of more than three decades. He publicly admitted that the Angelus painting was the source of his greatest anguish. In 1933, Dali began his architectonic Angelus of Millet, in which the peasant couple of Millet's painting were replaced by two megalithic monstrosities, at least vaguely male and female, if only by virtue of the Angelus analog, set against a garish and ominous sky. The church and its bell tower have been reduced to ruins, which are now completely dwarfed by these two figures. Lifeless monuments, cold, loveless to the point of indifference, dominating a landscape far more barren than the famine-blighted farmland in Millet's painting. Dali spewed invective on Millet's Angelus, calling it, quote, "miserable, tranquil, insipid, imbecilic, insignificant, stereotyped, and conventional to the most mournful degree," end quote, warning that it was a portent of something ominous. With alarm and almost Nietzschean perspicacity, he wrote that, quote, "under the grandiose hypocrisy of a content manifestly the sweetest and most worthless, something is happening," end quote. What was happening was an eccentric artist with great technical skill was scandalized by the work of a less gifted predecessor who was nevertheless more in touch with the hunger of the human heart and more acquainted with the subtle ways that Christ and his church awaken and feed that hunger. If it is possible to detect in Millet's painting a wistfulness about the passing of once familiar devotion, in Dali's case, we have a harbinger of what the demise of such devotions presages. Indeed, the two paintings might be seen as an artistic analog of the relationship between the warnings of Humani Vitae and the cultural and moral consequences of the rejection of these warnings. I'd like to close, if I may, by two quotations. The first is from Philip Reeve. "The de-ritualization of social life invites struggles for power." Think about that in terms of our contemporary political situation. The de-ritualization of social life invites struggles for power. Far from being an enlightened process, the destruction of ritual in Western culture is a major symptom of its demonic character, opening up the possibility of some persons feeding themselves on the destruction of others. It's written in the 60s. Here, indeed, sex and politics converge in an anti-creedal movement, a convulsive fury of systematic destruction, at once sexual and technological, end quote. And finally, let me quote from Cyril O'Regan. "On behalf of modernity, the Enlightenment presents the license to forget as essentially a matter of being human. The roots to be forgotten are endless and include the nation, ethnic group, community, physical place, social and gender roles, and so on. The Christian tradition, of course, is an object of such forgetting, indeed, historically, the prime one. since it represents an obstacle to the Enlightenment ethos in general and the imperative to forget in particular. In the memory enacted in literature, in its customs and cults, which bring the past to bear on the present, and its commitment to particular beliefs and values that appear to have timeless sanctions. End quote. So, Regan, may God give us the grace to participate more fully in the memory enacted in liturgy and to cherish the customs and cult that free us from the factory whistles and noise orchestras of our age. Thank you very much.
For more presentations by Gil Bailey and information about the Cornerstone Forum, please visit the Cornerstone Forum's website at www.cornerstone-forum.org. Thank you.